Let's see. Before I get into the next ceremony, I wanted to apologize for missing last Sunday. I've been feeling fairly wretched, and I was talking to Mr. Cotin, and he said, "So, do you have a wretched meter? How wretched do you feel?" I said, "This is about a 15 or 20 year wretched." So he's like, "Oh, whoops."
Is that like a 100-year flood?
Yeah, something like that. It reminds me of the period of time when I was in my 20s, and I would talk to Reverend Master Koshin, and he would refer to the karmic storms of your 20s, which I thought was a really nice phrase and kind of applies to most people that you go through a period in your 20s when things are pretty up, for a bit of upheaval. So, and relative to that, if you happen to notice me being weepy or whatever in the meditation hall or during ceremonies, please don't be worried. Just offer merit and let me kind of deal with it. But also, it makes me think of Bodhidharma's four practices: acceptance of suffering, sitting unmoved, seeking of nothing, enlightenment proved. And so during this period of time, I think there's something that I wanted to that I've been thinking of, which is that the acceptance of suffering is actually to completely feel suffering, to completely feel what arises, and to allow it to be there and not to grasp after. In meditation, we experience kind of feelings of peace or feelings of harmony during our day, and when suffering arises, that can seem to disappear. And part of the arising of suffering is the not knowing peace. And so in terms of understanding suffering, accepting suffering, to sit still in that place where we don't know peace, where we don't know harmony, and to allow ourselves to feel that is to come to understand a deeper kind of peace, a deeper kind of acceptance. And the sitting unmoved part, it's important to not worry about how. I mean, I'm aiming towards sitting unmoved during the arising of this, but I'm really not going to worry about how unmoved I am. I'm just going to keep trying to sit still, and in that way, see what's going on. And the seeking of nothing, it may be that you come to a point in your practice where you know you have found what you're looking for. You know that you have found some kind of peace in training, something that you know that you've been searching for all of your life. And still, there are parts of us, even when we know that, there are parts of us which are constantly seeking for something outside of ourselves. And we need to be able to honestly look at that and honestly say, oh, there is a part of me that's looking for something outside of myself for a solution, and to sit still with compassion and acceptance of that. And that's part of what we're looking for when we're feeling the arising of suffering. That's part of what we're looking, not in the sense of like searching for it, but in the sense of being aware of the possibility that it's there, that thing which reaches outside of ourselves to look for something, that seeking of something. And our ideal, of course, is to seek nothing. And we will come to know that through the practice of training. And enlightenment proved during the arising of this feeling of wretchedness, which may go on for some time, having the faith that there is a reason that we go through suffering, there is a reason for suffering, and that there is something beyond it. There is enlightenment. There is peace of mind at the other side of it. And even as we go along, we realize peace of mind is there, even though we may not know it. We know that it's there. It's a kind of strange knowing that comes about. So I just was thinking about those things and wanted to make that offering as well as talking about the ceremony for today. Before we go into the exact ceremony, I wanted to remind us of something we've talked about With regard to the chapters of Dogen that we were studying last fall and summer. And that's the idea of the mind that seeks the way, the mind of bodhicitta, the mind that attracts us to meditation practice that leads us to the Buddha Dharma. And that mind is something that arises within us. It's something that recognizes as true when we see it, the Buddha Dharma. So there's something about the Buddha Dharma that we see as being true on some level. Not just that it's factually correct, but that it applies to something within our own mind and heart. And part of Dogen makes the connection that part of that is seeing through the impermanence of things, seeing through to the impermanence of things. That the mind which perceives the way, the mind that seeks the way, understands that everything is impermanent. Everything that arises is impermanent. And on some level, while we may not completely accept that or completely like it or completely, you know, whatever, on some level, at the same time we recognize the truth of what the Buddha taught, we're recognizing that everything that arises is impermanent. And it's this recognition that I want to highlight as we're talking today. Because in a way, it is that recognition of the truth of what the Buddha taught, the truth of what our spiritual teachers and Sangha teaches, the truth of the three treasures. It's our heart's response to the truth of that that is what we're talking about here and is the thing of fundamental importance. I have said whenever I've talked about the arising of bodhicitta that we should be really careful of that, because it's something that we can easily obscure in the hurly-burly busyness of our daily life. There's some part of this that recognizes there it must be something more. There's something more to life. And I want to know that thing. And we should be careful to preserve that thing because it's precious and it will serve us well if we serve it. And so in a way, what I'm talking about today is a devotion, a kind of devotion to a thing that arises in our own heart, a thing of ourselves. It's not something that anybody else can do anything about. It's something that is independent of everyone, and yet it responds to what the Buddha taught and those who practice what the Buddha teaches. For myself, this thing arose first, I remember, this mind that seeks the way and this recognition of truth. Oddly enough, this will seem strange, I think. I first remember it when I was a small child, maybe 8 or 9, and my parents were, their relationship was falling apart, and my mom was going nuts trying to take care of 6 kids and figure out how to get along with my dad, who was fairly oblivious to the needs of other human beings. Nice man and everything, but just not really aware. So my mom was she would get very angry, and we were sitting at the dinner table. Maybe it was somebody's birthday. I don't know. Maybe it was even my birthday. And for some reason, she got up and walked behind me at the table. And I was terrified that she was going to hit me or yell at me or something like that. And I had this experience of just sort of light and water kind of coming at my back. And with this kind of feeling like, don't worry, it'll be okay. Excuse me while I compose myself. And it is that feeling, that recognition that there is something deeper, that has really been, for me, the thing that I return to in my spiritual life, and has grown, and that sense of there is something deeper, there is something that I can rely on, has been something that I've been able to cultivate and nourish through my Buddhist practice and the practice of meditation. So it's, I'm telling you this to say that this isn't just an academic or scholastic kind of discussion. It's quite personal. And I was thinking about, there's a story about Moggallana who, I think I've told you this story, where at the end of Moggallana was one of the chief disciples, the two chief disciples of the Buddha during the Buddha's lifetime. And at the end of Moggallana's life, he died before the Buddha did. He was set upon by bandits and beaten nearly to death. And he recognized that this was the karmic consequence of some former wrong action. And even though he was an arahant, one of the most enlightened of the Buddhist disciples, he accepted this consequence with equanimity and allowed these men to beat him to nearly to death. He held on long enough that he could crawl to where the Buddha was and die in the Buddha's presence. And to me, that devotion, that impulse to, in a sense, say to the Buddha, "Thank you for what you have taught me," is the kind of, this makes perfect sense to me, that a person would have that level of gratitude and appreciation for what the Buddha taught and what he has revealed to us, that a person would even go to that extreme to express his appreciation for it. So the ceremony that we're talking about today then is the ceremony of lay ordination. And lay ordination is, in a sense, it in itself encompasses all the other ceremonies of Jukai. And so you can do a lay ordination without the other ceremonies of Jukai, and the meaning of those other ceremonies of Jukai is embedded within the ceremony of lay ordination. So for those of us who are going to be doing the ceremony here at the temple, it is a great thing to be able to go to Jukai, but it is no fundamental loss. The teaching of those other ceremonies is embedded within the ceremony of Jukai, of lay ordination. And so I'll leave the analysis of the meaning of the particular elements to those other ceremonies as we talk about them, and so the meaning of those things will kind of be brought out. But the thing that is fundamentally additional to the other ceremonies of Jukai, in other words, the thing that lay ordination adds to Jukai, is that it's an opportunity for us to express our promise to the Buddha that we will follow through on our own commitment to that mind that seeks the way, to our own commitment to our own heart, to our own impulse to find the deeper truth in life. And so in that sense, that's the significance of the ceremony of lay ordination. It's not that we're making necessarily a promise to other Buddhists or other people or anything like that, or even in one sense to the Buddha, although the Buddha kindly receives our promise. It is that we are making a commitment of our own devotion to our own impulse to train, our commitment to our own impulse to the arising of bodhicitta within our own life. Now, one of the things that happens as a result of making that commitment is that we enter into the mandala of the Buddha. The word mandala means circle, okay? And in a way, when we become Buddhists, actually, even when we begin to practice Buddhism, when we just sit down to meditate, we have already kind of entered into the mandala of the Buddha. We've entered into the circle of the Buddha. We've entered into the protection of the Buddha and the teaching of the life of the Buddha. And that has its own profound significance. We may or may not see the profundity of what we're doing in the beginning, and that's fine, and we may even kind of wander away from it. And again, that's the way that a life goes. But we should come to hear at least once or twice that what we're doing has profound significance, has deeply profound significance. It is said that, in the Lotus Sutra, it is said that if you were to walk past a stupa is a monument enshrining the relics of a Buddha. If you were to walk past a stupa, you will realize enlightenment in the future just by the very act of walking past a stupa. And by the act of making the commitment, making the promise to ourselves that we're going to be following through on our promise to our heart, we are ensuring that we will become enlightened in the future. It might not take, it might take, you know, 500 lifetimes. Who knows how long it will take and what the path of our life will go on. But what we're doing here has a profound significance. And it starts by simply the taking of the three refuges. I go for refuge to the Buddha. I go for refuge to the Dharma. I go for refuge to the Sangha. That was the formulation that originally came about for a person to become a Buddhist. And in other traditions, in the Theravadan tradition, in the Mahayana traditions, in Tibet and China, when a person becomes a Buddhist, they go for refuge to the Buddha and they take the three refuges. That's the fundamental thing. And what they're doing is saying, I recognize the truth of what the Buddha taught, and I'm going to make that a part of my life. And when we do that, we're entering into the mandala of the Buddha. We're entering into the circle of the Buddha, entering into the life of the Buddha. For us, we not only at our lay ordination ceremony take the three refuges, but we're also committing ourselves to the Bodhisattva precepts, the precepts of the Buddhas. There's a line in one of the precept scriptures that says, the precepts are the conduct of Buddhas. So the 10 precepts, the 3 pure precepts and the 10 precepts are how Buddhas act in the world. And it comes back again to impermanence. We make the commitment because we recognize that impermanence exists. Impermanence is this potent and wild force that lives in the world. We can't live without it. We can't get away from it. It's there. It works to our advantage sometimes. It works to our disadvantage sometimes. And in a way, in the sense of which the precepts are talking about it, what we're doing is saying, oh, wow, there's impermanence. And what I'm going to do is promise myself that I'm going to act as best I can like a Buddha in the presence of impermanence. And that, again, has this profound significance. It's not only a thing which binds us to our word, but it invites the help and protection of the Buddhas. The Buddha is saying, oh, okay, well, you've promised, so I'll give you help with that. And that help is much more, is immeasurable. It is worth crawling to the Buddha on our deathbed and saying, thank you for. So we're confronted with impermanence. We see it moving. This inspires us to train and practice. And then we say, okay, well, how do I handle impermanence? What do I do? And the Buddhists say, here are the precepts. If you follow these precepts, if you study your actions with regard to the precepts, then you will have peace of mind. Then you will find this deeper truth. This is how Buddhas act in the world. There was a line that I came across recently that a former monk said that she took great comfort in, which is that all of, a line from Dogen, she had worked on translating to, on the translation project of Dogen. She said that all of the, Dogen says, all of the, none of the Buddhas have anything upon which they could rely. And all of the Buddhas understood this. There was nothing upon which they could rely. Now, we're just regular human beings, so we just kind of do what we do and make the best of it. But to understand that the Buddhas know deeply there is nothing upon which I can rely, and I'm going to keep the precepts. This is how I'm going to act. This is what we are aspiring to do in our life. And this is what we can achieve. It's really quite miraculous that the Buddha Dharma is created for human beings. So what that implies is that, or an expression of that is that one of the formulations for the precepts is, I vow to undertake to train myself to refrain from killing. So we're not saying I'm going to become perfectly able to not kill anything right away. I'm just going to make the promise to myself, to the Buddha, I'm going to work on this, basically, is what it's saying. I vow to undertake to train myself to refrain from killing. Okay. And so the Buddha is deeply kind. He knows what it's like to be a human being. And he says, okay, well, here's something you can work on. Here's a direction that you can go in. In a way, I've heard Uchiyama Roshi described his first experience of awakening to the truth as coming to understand the direction that he needed to head in his life. Now, that might sound a little bit kind of lackluster and disappointing for most people. You know, you want experience of enlightenment to be, wow, I'm, you know, feel great and I'm enlightened. But, and maybe there was part of that in what he first experienced. But the thing that a value that is left is that recognizing that that first experience is a past experience, a transient experience. The thing of value that is left is that deep sense of where I need to go, how I need to head, what the direction I need to go in. And as I go along, this kind of insight is the thing which I most deeply value and treasure. This kind of insight, because I recognize, you know, in my short Buddhist life, I've seen a lot of deeply enlightened people do some really screwy things. Just go and do some really nutso things. And it's really sobering. Like, well, that guy's a Zen master. How could he have done that? And you think, okay, where am I going? And you have to recognize, okay, well, he really was a Zen master, but you can go off in many directions. There are many distractions along the way. There are many sidelights. It is our commitment to the precepts which helps to ensure that that kind of thing will not happen to us. It is our promise to ourself to continue to seek the way. The mind that seeks the way in the beginning is can be embodied in a sense, there's something missing from my life. And then we might find that thing. And that mind that seeks the way is still there, though, because the mind that seeks the way turns into the mantra of great wisdom. It is the kind of central principle, the central idea of our tradition, the mantra of great wisdom, and the mind that seeks the way are the same. O Buddha, going, going, going on beyond, and always becoming Buddha. Going, going, going on beyond, always becoming Buddha. Gyate, gyate, hara gyate, harasa so gyate, boji so waka. This is a mantra that you would recite at Jukai during one of the ceremonies. We'll talk about that later. The mind that seeks the way and the mantra of great wisdom are the same. And we come to see them transform and become the same. We always must be humble, no matter how, what we know. We always have to take refuge in the three treasures, no matter what we know. And that's the going on beyond, always becoming Buddha. So I don't mean to get all heavy and scare anybody away or anything like that. I just would like to communicate the idea that the refuge of the three treasures is profound and can contain and respond to our needs as human beings. Virtually, as far as I can see, as far as what those needs are. It responds to where we are right now. Even if it might be, well, there's a story of a prostitute who as a joke, tried on a monk's robe, just as a kind of, you know, oh, well, that'll be fun. And in a future life became an arahant, you know, as a disciple of the Buddha, became an arahant. And so you might just, I'm a little ashamed to say, I had a girlfriend when I was in college, who I was starting to practice, and she wanted to be my girlfriend, and I wanted her to be my girlfriend. And I said, and she was, I was driving her crazy because of my spiritual aspirations. And so I said, well, if you want to understand me, you'll have to become a Buddhist. So she actually took the precepts in her effort to get along with me. I did not set out to like lever her into taking the precepts or anything. She voluntarily did it, and is really not practicing Buddhism now. She's one of my oldest friends at this point. I still go and visit her, and she's happily involved with somebody else and has a kid and all that stuff. And yet there was some merit in that. I don't know where it will go or anything like that. She doesn't regret it. She once told me, you know, one of the best things about you is your practice. Even though, as I say, I was driving her crazy with it in my youth. Again, there are just many different ways of going. I'm not advocating doing this, taking this step lightly or anything like that. I'm just trying to say, well, recently I was thinking there was a quality in my life of where becoming a monk felt like something I was kind of drawn and needed to do. Like I was kind of, in a sense, forced by my own kind of mind to do. But lately I was thinking about it and I realized that's just completely wrong. Becoming a monk has been a great gift that has been an opportunity for me. And taking the precepts in the same way has been a great gift that the Buddhas have offered to me. And so in that spirit, I think that's the kind of spirit that we can take the precepts, that here's an opportunity which we can try. Here's a thing which the Buddhas give us, this gift, this opportunity, and we can try it. So I think that's pretty much what I have to say for today. Is Reverend Master Rokusan having anything?
Yes, something that Reverend Leon alluded to. This is becoming a Buddhist, taking the precepts, is a profound step. It's something that we cannot know the consequences of. It will change your life. And don't make it a big deal. If you get the feeling, well, I kind of think, you know, I'm sort of interested, don't doubt that. Just because you're not doing whatever, I don't know, you're not enlightened, you know, whatever it is, don't doubt that within you that thinks, well, you know, for whatever reason, maybe this is a good thing to do. Because that's what you want to listen to. You want to give yourself that chance. It is a good thing to do when you feel like you may even be beginning to be ready for it. So I'm not trying to
lever someone
into
it.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not trying to. But if you've expressed it, don't doubt it. Okay, I say that, and I also say, if something strongly comes up, this is not good to do, don't ignore that either. Just follow your heart in this, and don't doubt that, and don't make it a really big deal, and know that it's a bigger deal than you can imagine, all at the same time. So, just be willing to take the next step. It's okay. And let go of the expectations. Let go of the shoulds. Let go of whatever you think ought to be there or might be there or anything else. I remember I was at one of my first week-long retreats at Shasta. And there were a couple of people that had started that retreat with me, you know, with a bunch of the lay people, that Reverend Master, during that retreat, okayed their wish to become a monk. And I was just absolutely in awe. I just thought, my God, you know, Kensho you know, what's going on here? That's just incredible. And I remember asking one of the people who's still at Shasta, you know, did you have an enlightenment experience? And she got hysterical. Not negatively. She was just laughing. It was the farthest thing from her mind. You know, this was my expectation I was putting on this thing. And it was so completely unreal. It was just simply her taking the next step in her training. It had nothing to do with my expectation of what this might mean. It was just following that mind that seeks the way, following the bodhicitta that Leon was talking about. And so that's what our training is, daily. Following that. And sometimes it's big, it's good to do it in bigger ways, like, you know, publicly becoming a Buddhist, publicly taking the precepts, and sometimes it's good to do it in smaller ways, like getting out of bed in the morning when you don't necessarily feel like it. Or letting go of that voice that says I can't or I don't want to. Not ignoring it, not hating it, just not letting it control us. Just doing what needs to be done. And that's what training is.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. And it's just really that it's just a movement of the heart that we just follow. And sometimes it's quite ineffable and something quite just, you know, offhand and ordinary, and sometimes it's, you know, quite big or whatever. But we just are just constantly looking for that, you know, kind of being still and listening for that movement of the heart, and being willing to just keep coming back to that place and trusting that thing is profound. Please.
I'm a little confused about all the Buddhas not having anything to rely on. I mean, I understand about I'm fully responsible for how I react to whatever happens to me. Of course, I'm not responsible for what may happen to me, but I'm responsible for how I react to it. But I always thought, even the Buddhas, can't they rely on the truth that they've found for themselves? Isn't there something even bigger, like the eternal?
The truth that you find is that everything needs to be let go of. And so the Diamond Sutra kind of phrases it like this. What is the true paramita of dana? What is the true paramita of generosity? The true paramita of generosity is giving without self and recognizing there are no beings to give to. There's no one who gives. There is just giving. And in the sense of what the Buddhas are talking about, in the sense of what that means, is that at a certain point, you recognize there is no one here to rely on anything. There is nothing, no thing that's permanent that can be relied upon. And to be living in that place all of the time is to let go of the person who relies upon, the thing that's relied upon, and the relying upon something.
Because that implies a separateness.
Because it implies a duality, yes. And because in that place, you no longer need to construct that duality. There is just life. But we have to be really careful. Because, you know, a lot of times people can say, well, I know this place, and so I can do what I want. And if you think that, there's going to be trouble. What Reverend Master Jiyu taught was, as long as we're human beings, we can be acted upon by our past karma. no matter what level we are at, we can be acted upon by our past karma. The Buddha had this arise in his own mind. There are at least four times in the Buddha's life where Mara comes to him and says, well, you know, you could just, these guys are really obnoxious, you could just set this aside and go off and, you know, be a king somewhere. Wouldn't be so bad. You could just do that. And the Buddha says, I see you, Mara. I see you. I see you there. And what he's really saying is, I see the self arising here in me. I will let go of this. So we need to be really, really careful. The more we go along, the more we know and practice, the more careful, in a way, we have to be, the more it's important that we take refuge in the three treasures.
That's why it's so important to continue to take refuge in the sun, which is another thing every master taught and taught and taught and taught. And that's why we recommend, you know, that you do take refuge in the sun. Do find a teacher and do continue to have contact with the group that's doing their best to train. And, you know, not just... And yes, the Dharma is important, but not just out of books, is what I'm saying. You know, real human beings.
And that's hard, because real human beings are a real pain in the ass sometimes. Sorry to put it like that, but there it is. It's true. And we just have to, you know, somebody told me recently that they thought about going to a monastery to kind of get away from life. And I think I think that's a kind of common view. You know, you think, oh, I'll go and be a monk or a nun and be peaceful and all that stuff and get away from life. But if you go to a Zen, if you meet somebody who's lived in a Zen monastery, particularly beyond the time when they're novices, that person deserves, no matter how screwy they are, they deserve to be bowed to. Because what they have gone through is, in a sense, someone putting them in a straitjacket and saying, sit here and look at yourself. Sit here and don't move when people are being annoying. And going through that process is really hard. It's really difficult. No matter how kind of quiet and peaceful and nice the temple is where you are, just sitting down, you all know this, sitting down to look at yourself day after day is deeply difficult. And yet, it is quite possible. It is quite possible and helpful.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.